The second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota Appellant versus Derek Carruthers Appellee. For the appellant is Mr. Gary Campbell, an Assistant Attorney General, and for the appellee, Mr. Carruthers, is Sean O'Brien, an attorney from Brookings. Must be Brookings Day today. Mr. Campbell, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I thank the court for this opportunity to bring this intermediate appeal, since it is discretionary with the court. The defendant in this case, Derek Crawford, is charged with three counts: sexual contact with a child under 16, a class 3 felony, kidnapping, a class 1 felony, and criminal pedophilia, a class 1 felony. The way this case started was ST, a 4-year-old girl, 4 years and about 10 months, I believe, in age, went to her mother and reported that the defendant had molested her. Now, the defendant was a friend of the family. The mother indicated that she had known him about a month, and she felt confident enough to leave her children in his care. She and her husband were absent one night, and during that night, the defendant fondled her private parts, according to the child. The same thing happened a day later. So we have two, possibly three incidents. After the second one, which happened during the night, the day after the first one, the child went to her mother in the bathroom, closed the door, pushed a chair up against it in lieu of a lock, because she couldn't reach the lock. And this was because the defendant was standing was in the room outside, right outside the bathroom. And she tells her mother what happened. The mother contacts the hospital. The child and the mother go to the hospital. And at the hospital, the child speaks to a Deputy Sheriff Hader. Over about 5 to 10 minutes, he asks her questions and gets her version of what happens. And that's basically that. About a week later, an interview is held with her involving Colleen Brazil, who's a member of an organization called Child's Voice. And she conducts what they call forensic interviews for the purposes of treatment. She testified that a physician or a healthcare provider, whatever, watches the interviews while they're going on from outside. The videotape of that interview was provided to the police and is an exhibit in this case. So we're looking at three statements, one to the mother, one to the detective, and not the detective, the Deputy Hader, and one to Colleen Brazil.
Why are the second two statements considered to be testimonial statements when the statements of the child to the mother was considered to be a non-testimonial statement?
Well, this case all revolves around Crawford v. Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court case earlier this year. And in that case, it drew the distinction between non-testimonial and testimonial statements. And it said that the Confrontation Clause prohibits the admission of testimonial statements if, when the statement is made, there's no opportunity to cross-examine. And in the state's view, if the child does not testify at trial. Under footnote 9 in Crawford, the court says that if the out-of-court declarant testifies at trial, that satisfies the Confrontation Clause.
I realize that, but my question is why are the statements of the child to the mother considered to be non-testimonial, whereas the statements to Hager and to the woman from Child's Voice considered to be testimonial?
Well, that's the distinction between testimonial and non-testimonial is not really defined and Crawford. Now, Crawford sets out some examples of the type of statements that are testimonial. Prior testimony, police interrogations, and formalized, you know, statements in a formal setting where there's an emphasis on gathering evidence for trial. Now, the statement to the mother, several courts have looked at this and said that a statement to a friend, an acquaintance, or a close relative does not qualify as testimonial because it's not a situation where the declarant is thinking in terms of investigation and prosecution, which is a contrast to police interrogation. And I think in this case, since the child's voice employee, Ms. Brazil, testified that these interviews aren't set up unless it's already been reported to law enforcement and that the tape is forwarded to law enforcement afterwards, I think that it's better for the purposes of this case on these facts to consider that to be testimonial.
Well, Mr. Campbell, would you, to follow up on that, would you clarify for us, please? As I read this case, I didn't see that mother's testimony is even at issue. The only issue in the case is the two other testimonial statements where the trial judge said prior cross-examination was required.
Right, Your Honor. That is the absolute crux of this appeal.
So am I correct that mother's statement's not at issue in this appeal?
In the state's view, yes.
Right. It's admissible whether she's available at trial or not.
Right, because it's non-testimonial. And it comes in under SDCL 19-16-38.
But nobody appealed that issue, that ruling by Judge Keenan.
No. The state agreed with the position that the trial court took regarding the mother's statement.
And there's no notice of review on that.
No notice of review and no petition by the defense. So in the state's view, that issue isn't really before the court. What is before the court is whether Crawford requires, where the declarant testifies at trial, What Crawford says in the state's view is that where the declarant testifies at trial, there does not need to be a prior opportunity for cross-examination, which unfortunately is what Judge Gienapp decided. Now, he looked at the main body of the Crawford case, and the Crawford case involved a wife's, I think, preliminary hearing testimony, which was admitted by the trial court, although she was not available to testify because her husband, who was the defendant, exercised the spousal privilege, and she was not allowed to testify. So she's unavailable, her statement comes in. What Crawford did was basically abandon the Ohio v. Roberts indicia of reliability test, where the trial court can look at the statement, decide it's reliable for a variety of reasons, and then let it in even if she's unavailable. Under Crawford now, provided it's a testimonial statement or a non-testimonial statement, the declarant has to testify. If it's a non-testimonial statement, then really the testimony isn't necessary. But if it's testimonial, the defendant has to have the right of cross-examination at trial or at the time the statement's made. Now, cross-examination of the time statement's made is virtually impossible in a lot of cases. If it's an investigation, say at the point in this case where Deputy Hader meets the girl at the hospital, there are no charges, no investigation at that point. He's just notified that the child is going to be there to report, you know, have this problem dealt with. He drives out there. Now, where is a right to counsel in existence at that point? There isn't any. Practically speaking, does the sheriff have to go and get a council appointed before he can go talk to her? I mean, practically, it doesn't make sense. And what...
Well, but the confrontation clause doesn't care whether it's practical or whether it makes sense or whether it's beneficial. The concepts behind the confrontation clause.
Well, yes, we
don't care about any of that.
We have to follow the confrontation clause and the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of it. But since the Crawford opinion in footnote 9 specifically says that Crawford does not apply where the declarant testifies at trial and is subject to cross-examination, the trial court's ruling is legally wrong.
Was there any indication the child would not be able to testify? There was nothing to that effect, or was there? I guess I'm wondering whether or not it was apparent to the trial court that maybe the child, although would be called as a witness, really wouldn't be able to testify.
Actually, what the trial court decided was that the child was competent to be a witness, that she had sufficient ability to recall, to speak, and she had a sufficient understanding of right and wrong, which was the test in that regard. So, and now there are difficulties. I mean, she's, I guess, 5 years old now, and a 4 to 5 year old child understanding and questioning is going to create problems. Now, at the first motion hearing, she testified. At times, when asked, "Well, did you speak to a policeman at the hospital?" No. She later is asked if she speaks to a deputy. No. "Well, did you speak to Deputy Hayter?" Yes. So you have inconsistencies which I think are generated by the child's misunderstanding of questions or her disorganized. Now, Colleen Brazil, the child's voice expert, she testified that when you look at children's statements, there can be inconsistencies from one to the next, and that's largely a function of a young child's inability to organize a story and tell it. It doesn't mean that the inconsistencies mean that the statements are false and that they're made up or that they're coached. What Hayter indicated was that she did not think that happened in this case, that she thought that ST was not a suggestible child, that her statements were relatively detailed. Now, the first statement to the mother is not, because the mother didn't follow up much. But in the statements to the officer and the statements to Brazil, the statements are much more detailed, and she looks at that as an indication that it's not suggestibility that's bringing these up. It's not her talking to adults that is bringing this up. She looked at the child's, use of language, their parent understanding. She got the impression that, just as the trial court concluded, that she knew right from wrong and that the child was capable of testifying. Now, there are going to be gaps in memory, but that doesn't mean that the confrontation at trial is ineffective. Now, there's always a risk, as happened in the Robert Leroy Anderson trial, where a young child can pull her blanket over her head and refuse to testify. And in that situation, you could end up in a situation where a mistrial might be necessary. You might not. In Anderson, the court decided that a mistrial wasn't necessary. But the trial court has to take control of the matter, be very careful in how it allows things to go on, and the parties have to be careful also. For instance, if the state were to get up and argue, she told Colleen Brazil A, B, C, D, E, and then it turns out she can't testify. Well, under Crawford, there's a real problem. And whether the trial court's instructions to ignore that would be enough, I don't know. That's something really would need to be developed at trial.
Well, as I understand this, Judge Genap reserved all this to make a ruling on availability later on when the child was going to testify.
I believe so. Now, he did find that she was competent as a witness, and he did find indicia of reliability in the consistency of the statements, the setup, the testimony of Brazil and the mother and such. But a lot of what the defendant is trying to argue is speculation based on what might happen.
Well, didn't he,
there's a risk there, that's true.
Didn't he expressly defer the availability determination?
Yes. Well, he said that it would depend on what happened at trial. But, I think availability, the competence as a witness, is very closely related to that. So I think that the trial court certainly did not prevent her from testifying.
Well, before your time expires, let's get to the merits of this. In your research, have you found any published opinion that would support Judge Genep's opinion in this case?
No, I haven't. And I found, as cited in the brief and in that the late supplemental brief I filed yesterday, and I provided counsel a copy of that opinion on Monday, so it's not a trial by ambush. The case law that has evolved, a lot of the cases are unpublished opinions, so their value is limited. Several of them are reported, including the one in the supplemental brief. And what the cases, in my view, uniformly say is that where the declarant testifies at trial under footnote 9 of Crawford, that is sufficient. Footnote 9 expressly limits the holding of Crawford. So in my view, the state's view, Judge Genep erred, and he should be reversed. Now, if there are no further questions, I'll yield my place.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. O'Brien, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court and counsel, Sean O'Brien, representing the defendant, Derek Crothers. In my opinion, this case involves the two things, the proper interpretation of the Crawford versus Washington decision, and then the proper application of the Crawford principles to the facts of this case. Now, Crawford overruled Ohio versus Roberts, and that basically had to do with the admission of unavailable witness statements. And in Ohio versus Roberts, they said that you had to have some indicia of reliability for that statement to be introduced. Crawford overruled that, saying that test was too subjective. And under Crawford, rightly or wrongly, the court said that the witness had to be unavailable, and also that the statement had to be subject to cross-examination at the time it was made. Now, there's differing opinions regarding the proper interpretation of the Crawford decision. And as Judge Genep pointed out in his decision, the National Center of Prosecution of Child Abuse interprets Crawford the way that the state would have this court interpret it. But Professor Richard Friedman interprets Crawford the way that Judge Genep interprets Crawford. And it's important to note that Justice Scalia, who wrote the decision in Crawford, he cites Professor Friedman and his law review article that was published in the Georgetown Law Review Journal back in 1998. And the portion of the decision that Justice Scalia cites Professor Friedman, and if I can quote, says, "Members of this court and academics have suggested that we revise our doctrine to reflect more accurately the original understanding of the Confrontation Clause. They offer two proposals. The second proposal, that we impose an absolute bar to statements that are testimonial, absent a prior opportunity to cross-examine. This case squarely implicates the second proposal." So obviously Justice Scalia was relying in part on Professor Friedman's article when deciding this case. Now,
how do you coincide that with the footnote?
Footnote 9, which the state basically is hanging their hat on, has to do with prior inconsistent statements. In footnote 9, Justice Scalia references the case of California versus Green, and that was a case where dealt primarily with the admissibility of prior inconsistent statements. And in footnote 9, Scalia says, Justice Scalia says, the Confrontation Clause does not bar admission of a statement so long as the declarant is present at trial to defend or explain it. Now, as Judge Gienap pointed out in his decision, defending or explaining would be something unique to an inconsistent statement. So first of all, I think you have to find that there is some type of inconsistent statement in order for footnote 9 to apply. And here, that's not the case. We don't have a situation where we have a prior inconsistent statement. So we would argue that footnote 9 does not apply. And even if it were to apply, let's just assume, for the purpose of argument, that footnote 9 applies. Then you come down to the issue of availability and whether the child is available. Now, that's something that the defense made a motion on, and the judge denied the motion, but he did state that that would be something that would probably be better suited to be addressed at the time of trial. I've got concerns about the manner in which that issue should be decided and whether it should be decided at the time of trial or whether it would probably be better to be decided prior to the trial, because you've got a situation, if you're going to go and start the trial and have the members of the jury listen to testimony of the child without making a decision as to whether or not that child is available, and really what that means is whether the child is able to give meaningful testimony under this court's decision in State versus McCafferty.
You know, though, isn't that the right way to do it? It seems to me, at least from my experience, with a child of that age, you really don't ever know for sure whether the child's going to be really effective or available or be able to testify until that moment comes. Unfortunately, you know, you just don't know what they're going to do.
Well, and I believe maybe this court should maybe provide some direction to the lower court on that issue as far as the timing or whether it would be appropriate to have a pretrial hearing on a motion in limine or something like that.
Why would we provide guidelines? The trial court's there. The child court can see the child, can view the child, hear the child testify, is in a far better position to decide whether or not the child's available at trial or not.
Correct. The point I was making is that I think that should be done outside the presence of a jury.
Before the trial?
Before the trial.
Well, Mr. Campbell brought up the Robert Leroy Anderson case under, which was a huge trial to try, very long. And if the child refused cross-examination, he suggested the specter of a mistrial starting all over again. So for economy, wouldn't you think it would be better to make the determination prior to trial than having to pull a plug on a trial that's already well into its... you're trying to advocate?
Yes, I believe that would be proper, because the other practical problem you have under SDCL 19-1638 is under that statute, if the court determines that the child is unavailable, then there's another element that the state must prove, and that would be corroborative evidence that the state would have to introduce. Now, they would have no idea whether or not they would need to do that until the court made a determination as to whether or not the child was unavailable. But the point I would like to emphasize is that I think, based upon the limited testimony that the child gave at the motions hearing, which was some 5 months after the alleged incident took place, it's my opinion, in reading the transcript, that that child could not give meaningful testimony. She simply was unable to answer a lot of the questions imposed by Judge Gienap and by the state's attorney and myself. She said she couldn't remember what she told her mother. And so the practical problem that we're facing is that this trial will probably be scheduled sometime in the middle of the summer, perhaps. She was 4 years old at the time she first gave these statements. She's still quite young. More than 20 months will have passed from the time that she first gave the statements to the time she testifies at trial, and I think it's reasonable to assume that her memory is not going to get any better, and most likely she's not going to be able to remember anything of what she told her mother. She couldn't remember 5 months after her first conversation with her mother. I think that it poses a huge problem as far as her availability, as far as the testimony is concerned, and so if she's not available, then I think under the Crawford decision, the testimony should not be allowed.
You're going to give the defendant a free ride just on the basis that you don't think she's going to be able to testify at the, or be available and testify at the trial?
If that's the situation, then applying the Crawford test, there has to be the prior opportunity for cross-examination, which there wasn't in this case.
Even under the state's theory, if she won't testify at trial.
Correct, and there's been some case law, and I'll cite U.S. versus Spotted Warbon. In that case, the court stated that they recognize that some children may be too young or too frightened to be subject to a thorough direct or cross-examination, and the child's physical presence alone would not satisfy the confrontation clause. In such a case, the child is, for all practical purposes, unavailable. Where the child witness is not available for meaningful cross-examination, the defense may move to strike any testimony of the child. So there's precedent for that.
But the state could put on the evidence, put on the testimony of the mother who was told that she was violated by, the mother was told that the child was violated by the child. And that could go in because that's non-testimonial, right?
I think you're probably correct. I did not file a notice of review on that particular matter, even though I did propose findings that all three statements were testimonial. But I think probably a fair reading of Crawford would hold that the statements that were given to the mother probably are not testimonial. The Crawford court didn't spend much time defining what was testimony or non-testimony. They gave some examples, and obviously the statements to law enforcement would be testimonial, no doubt about it. The child's voice is a little closer question, but I think Judge Genep was right in his decision that was testimonial. So I probably the testimony of the mother would be admitted at the time of trial. Let me address the standard of review, because that came up a little bit. And we believe that the correct standard of review in this case is the abuse of discretion. And we rely on the cases of, it's the case that the state just filed its supplemental brief on, People versus Ramirez. And that was a similar situation where we had a young child who was going to testify at the time of trial. And they decided that based upon an abuse of discretion standard. And also,
the question here is narrow. It's strictly whether prior cross-examination of this type of statement is required by the Confrontation Clause. Isn't that the very narrow legal issue that's involved in this case?
That's one of the issues, Justice.
But that wouldn't be an abuse of discretion standard review. I mean, that's a constitutional question of law, isn't it?
That is, but it's applying that standard to the rules of evidence, and as this court stated in the State versus Herman, and that had to do with the application of 1916-38, which we're dealing with here today. The court said that the admission of a child victim's statement under SDCL 1916-38 was governed by an abuse of discretion standard. So we think that this court has provided some precedent for that view. And the point
you're saying that even if we determine that Judge Genep erred, that it's within his discretion, that it's not, and therefore could be read not to be an abuse of discretion?
That was the point I was just about to make. I think Judge Genep might be listening over the internet, so I want to score some points with him. But obviously, before he became a member of the bench, you know, he was probably, and I'm sure all of you recognized Judge Genep as being one of the top outstanding criminal defense lawyers in the state. And so even though there might be some disagreement amongst yourselves, the justices, and the proper application of your interpretation of Crawford, and if you adopt the abuse of discretion standard, That does give him some discretion in that respect, and we would urge the court to rule that he did not abuse that discretion. I believe that probably covers everything that I wanted to cover. Okay. Unless
how would you respond to the Colorado case that was just submitted to us yesterday?
Yes.
Have you had time to look at it first, well, though?
I did, and Mr. Campbell did advise me, I think it was Monday, that he was going to use this case. I would distinguish that case, and I had a chance to look at it. And again, similar situation, child abuse, but there is no trial yet. In that case, I think the facts are a little distinguishable. The kids were under 10, but they don't state how old they were, but I would, so we don't know that. But what the court basically stated in that case is that, and again, they looked at footnote 9 and said that the kids are going to be able to testify. They're going to be there. So I think what the court really did is assume that the kids would be available. And so the problem I have with that case is they didn't talk and they didn't discuss anything about footnote 9 only applying to prior inconsistent statements. That was never an issue that was dealt with by that case. And again, they assumed that the children would be available. And again, that was never an issue that the court dealt with in that case. And finally, I think it was just basically, as I started out saying, there's two different interpretations, Justice Friedman's interpretation and the other's interpretation. I think they just basically took the wrong interpretation of what the Crawford decision means in that case. So that's why I would distinguish Ramirez. The facts are a little bit different than this case.
Have you found any other published decision that's followed the Friedman view?
I have not, Your Honor. Of course, it's a recent decision, so I'm sure that as time goes by, there will be more decisions coming out on this case.
I don't think Judge Gienab had any decision probably before him at the time he had to make this ruling, did he?
No. What he relied upon, and it's stated in his memorandum of opinion, but he relied quite a bit on Professor Friedman's post-Crawford analysis, and that's found in a publication as to how Friedman interprets Crawford. And he also, to balance that, he also looked at the publications from this National Center for Prosecution of Child Abuse, so he could temper both arguments. But that's basically all he did state to me, though, I guess it's off the record, that he did have discussions with professors down at the law school and other individuals too, and so he had the opportunity to discuss this with other academics as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Campbell, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Well, to address the defendant's argument piece by piece is perhaps a little beyond what I'm going to do here. Regarding Judge Gienab's decision, I do agree with counsel that he had very little time in which to decide this, that Crawford was so new that there hadn't been really any legal development. But the legal development that's taken place since then indicates, at least to me, that the defendant's position and Judge Gienab's was incorrect. I think it's a matter of taking things out of context. The statements where Justice Scalia writes that there has to be a prior opportunity for cross-examination are taken out by that footnote 9, and the green citation in footnote 9 does not negate the footnote. It's simply an example. If you look at footnote 9, what it says is, finally, we reiterate that when the declarant appears for cross-examination at trial, the confrontation clause places no constraints at all on the use of his prior testimonial statements. Then there's a cite to Green. It is therefore irrelevant that the reliability of some out-of-court statements cannot be replicated, even if the declarant testifies to the same matters in court. That's a cite to Rehnquist's writing, quoting United States v. Anati, goes on, "The clause does not bar admission of a statement so long as the declarant is present at trial to defend or explain it. The clause also does not bar the use of testimonial statements for purposes other than establishing the truth of the matter asserted." Now, what Judge Genap latched onto is the language of, well, first the cite to Green, which is a prior inconsistent statement case, and then the language about the declarant being present at trial to defend or explain the prior statements. Now, defend or explain the trial statements, that applies equally well to any cross-examination, or for that matter, direct examination. It isn't something that's strictly limited to prior inconsistent statements. And that was really one of the hinge points of Judge Genap's decision. I think he read it too narrowly. I think the professor, Friedman, read things too narrowly. I admit I haven't read his writing, but I think the Supreme Court opinion is quite clear that the defendant's position simply is contrary to Crawford itself. Now, regarding availability, that is always going to be a problem because, as Justice Zinner pointed out, you just don't know what is going to happen. I think a large part of defendant's concerns actually aren't really valid in that if there are gaps in memory, it doesn't mean that she's incompetent to testify, doesn't mean she's unavailable. If she can testify to the circumstances of the interviews, whether they happen or not, even if she forgets one of the interviews, forgets talking to one of the persons, if she can testify to the substance of the statements, the events that occurred, the actual assault on her, then that satisfies confrontation. And that's under the, I think it's the Warner case. I mean, there are cases that I've cited where the declarant comes in and says, "Hey, I didn't say that at all, or I was lying." But he or she can be cross-examined on that. And if she remembers some interviews and not others under Warner, that is still sufficient. Now, there's going to be a dividing line somewhere between what's adequate and what isn't adequate, but it's not a simple open and shut issue like the defendant says that it is. I think it's.
Do you look at Crawford then as availability being the threshold question? That if the child is available, then really it need go no further than that?
Under the confrontation clause.
Because once they're available, they're always subject to cross-examination.
Right.
Now, so it's only when they're unavailable does the second question come into play then. Does their out-of-court, do the out-of-court statements come in? And then the next question on whether or not it meets the confrontation clause in that, were they subject to cross-examination?
Right.
Is now, that how you see it? Is that, how you read Crawford?
That's generally how I see it, but there is a problem with this aspect. Mr. O'Brien suggested that, well, if she isn't capable of testifying, then you go to indicia of reliability, and that is the old Ohio v. Roberts approach, which Crawford threw out. Basically, in a nutshell, my view of Crawford is that regarding non-testimonial statements, the declarant does not have to testify. Regarding testimonial statements, which two of these three in all likelihood are, then the testimony at trial and cross-examination at trial is essential. And that's where I think Judge Genap, pardon the expression, went off the track, in that he overemphasized prior opportunity to confront. Now that would satisfy confrontation, but in this case that did not occur. And under Crawford in footnote 9, the prior opportunity to cross-examine isn't necessary.
So you're saying that if the child is available in the sense that the child is physically available, appears in court, either immediately prior or in the trial itself, and can state her name and can say that she remembers having a conversation with her mother about it, she remembers having a conversation with a police officer about it, she remembers having a conversation with the child's voice representative, but she doesn't remember at all what she said, then she's subject to cross-examination and it makes her testimony admissible.
No, I think that's going a bit too far. I think she has to have some memory of the incident and be able to testify to the what actually occurred at the time. And that's that's included in the cases that I've cited. She can't just testify to, I spoke to someone. There has to be a component of what she spoke about and what happened. Now, if she speaks to three people, I don't think she has to testify to the substance of what she said to each one. I don't think that is required. But she has to have some memory and some ability to testify as to what happened. Now, just exactly where the dividing line is, I don't frankly know. I think that's something that has to be developed through case law and the records that are generated. Now, regarding the standard of review, if you look at the Colorado case, which does say that the trial court did not abuse its discretion under the Colorado evidentiary rules, it reaches that conclusion after concluding that because the children were available to testify and would testify, of course, that's always open to question as to what's going to happen in the future. But it said that in the circumstances of the case, Crawford did not apply. That's the question it asked first before it gets to the rules of evidence. And in my opinion, that case does not stand for the proposition that the application of the Confrontation Clause under Crawford is a matter of state evidentiary rules. I think it's de novo because it's the finest example of a narrow constitutional law issue that I can think of. And with that, I'll close. And unless there are further questions, I do request that the trial court's rulings regarding the latter two statements of the child be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.